Welcome to Uncharted Living. We're your hosts, Christine, Rebecca, and Ty. We are life coaches who are committed to the road less traveled. Join us each week for thought-provoking and entertaining conversations, all designed to help you create your own map. Uncharted Living. It's just the beginning. Don't be afraid to get life started.
Hello, fellow humans, and welcome back to Uncharted Living. Ty and I are delighted today to be joined by Miri Rodriguez, author of the amazing book, Brand Storytelling, Put Customers at the Heart of Your Brand Story. Miri is an award-winning storyteller, influential thinker, and senior storyteller for Future of Work at Microsoft, and has earned recognition for her outstanding work in branding, digital marketing, and customer experience. She has worked with clients including Adobe, Discovery, Walmart, and McKesson. She is also the proud owner of Be Mindful, Be Happy, a mindfulness company offering products and services for holistic well-being and happiness. Miri, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much, Ty. And I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Christine. I'm so excited. We were talking in the back, the green room, about our commitments and how we come together. And I'm always a believer that when we are in each other's space, you know, I think of it as a train. We're all on each other's train, jumping in and out. And so here we are at a station. Finally, we got together to talk. So I'm excited.
I love it.
Awesome.
I love it.
Thank you so much, Miri.
I love your book. I love, love, love your book.
Thank you.
So for our listeners, and actually for me too, mindfulness. Yes. And Microsoft don't really seem to go together. Yeah, you've clearly led an uncharted life, which is what we on the podcast and our listeners are all about. Can you tell us and our listeners a little bit about your background and your career in tech as a Latina woman?
Absolutely. So I would say no, but also yes and no, because it became to me a bridge I had to cross and I didn't know how. And so a little bit about that backstory is, I came into tech almost by mistake. My sister was working at the time at Motorola. She right out of college. I was navigating my own spaces. I'm from South Florida. And so I was actually working at a yachting company and just, you know, right out of college, whatever was next, whoever would hire me, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And eventually my sister submitted my resume at Motorola and I got into tech that way. A few years later, Microsoft called. I received just a phone call, and it was Microsoft, a recruiter. So I got recruited into tech, into big tech, what we call big tech. And that really started my career at Microsoft, which I honestly thought, I'm like, how long will I be here? Max 2 years. I mean, it's been 11 now. I'm like, I'm still here.
Oh, wow.
Completely not thinking that I would be here this long. And the reason I have been, I think, is exactly that. You know, I've learned from a soft skill perspective how to become something I wasn't. And one of those things was empathetic. So I was not empathetic. If you met me 11 years ago, not very empathetic. That comes with mindfulness. There's an intention of how you're going to show up and who you're going to be, who your brand is, how you make people feel. So all these things kind of were swimming around and I was finally like, I get it. So as I navigated tech and the very interesting world is engineering, not being an engineer, I was learning the hard way how to become more mindful.
Wow.
So Miri, when you started, do you have a BA in computer science or something?
Oh God, no. And that's another question I get. A lot of people are like, how do you break into tech? I don't. And I actually, so funny you ask, I wanted to become a jet fighter pilot. I went to school 4 years of ROTC, Air Force ROTC.
What?
But and I became like the first female corps commander of my battalion. It was like crazy. And I got a scholarship to go to Colorado Springs. I had my mind set, I'm going to be a jet fighter pilot. However, culturally, we don't do that. You know, and my parents, my dad specifically was very strict. And he was like, you don't go away to college. You stay home. And the only way you leave your house is if you get married. So I took a regular scholarship, a local scholarship, and I went to local school. I ended up going to a community college and then transferred. So my dreams were shattered, right? I was like, what's next? This was my path. Like, this was my dream. And so I go to my school to sign up for whatever. And my teacher was like, the counselor was like, listen, your entrance exam was really good. You're probably a good writer. And I was like, yeah, whatever. Just sign me up for anything. So she signs me up for communications. And I'm like, is that an easy A? Just give me the easy A. I just want to get my paper. I'm like, 18 and depressed and the world is ending, right? So I got into comms and no science BA, comms, because that was the thing to do. And what would get me the A and get me my bachelor, I ended up doing comms and then actually got my my master's in comms as well, comms and marketing.
Oh my gosh.
That is fighter pilot to Microsoft. We have a new... Yeah. Title for this episode.
Crazy. I mean, I look back and I know this is where I'm supposed to be, but as an 18-year-old, I was like, my whole world shattered. It's one of those things.
Wow.
So crazy. So, so what do you actually do then at Microsoft? Like, what does senior storyteller for future work mean? I mean, I read it off and it sounds really important and cool. I actually don't know.
And kind of made up.
It's not made up, I promise. Actually, we have around 4,000 storytellers worldwide at Microsoft. So it is a title, and there's a lot of us out there. Yeah. But when I came in 6-7 years ago into this, it didn't exist. So you're right. It was made up at some point. When Satya Nadella, our CEO, came on board as CEO, he endeavored to really kind of, change the culture to be empathetic. He wanted us to be learn-it-alls. He says we used to be like, oh, we're know-it-alls. We're at Microsoft, we're know-it-alls, very, very, very crass ideas and really egocentric, I would say. I'm one of them. And then he's like, no, let's be learn-it-alls. Let's learn, let's be empathetic to our customers. And so he started thinking about storytelling from a brand storytelling perspective. How can we tell the stories of how we at Microsoft are digital transforming from on-premises to the cloud, a time that was very obscure, a time that was for engineers, these engineers they were never cloud engineers. They had never been that before. Cloud didn't exist. So they're taking this stuff there, not knowing what's going to happen next. So it was a very ambiguous time for them. And so we brought people like me, comms and marketing majors, to go tell the stories. So we sat in engineering to tell the stories of engineers to engineers. And so that's where it all broke for me. I had no idea how to do it. And that's where the book came from. It was all the learnings of the things that I failed at. It was like how to's. So that's and that's not a made-up title. So now I'm actually sitting as a storyteller, senior storyteller for it's HPSI, Health, Publics, and Services Industries. And my audience is government agencies, education, healthcare. So we're telling stories of how our products at Microsoft enable the agencies to deliver citizenship services, which are amazing. The stories are great. I love it.
Oh, so you're putting, okay. So it's a story of how your product and your company can help them. And then it's sort of like another story of how then they are going to help their customers. Right.
Yeah. So it's stories of how it's not just how we are so good and our products are good. It's how we are empowering, let's say, governors, for example. These are elected officials. They're public officials. And they come, and they sign up for this because they have a story. They have a personal, agenda to go deliver something for their citizens in their city or state. And so I recognize that. I come in and I'm like, hey, and let's say they sign up for, Power Apps for Microsoft. And I'm like, hey, why did you do this? Why did you sign up? What is your thing about partnering with Microsoft for what? And so we hear the why, we hear the personal story behind that and how they're really looking to serve their citizens. And these stories are fascinating. I mean, these public officials really truly are looking to enhance the customer experience, the citizen experience. And so we get to tell that story versus, our product is great. So these are personal stories of the whys and the hows and how they affect everyday people like me and you.
Can you give us an example? Working with a particular governor or Just tell us how that kind of actually works. Yeah.
You did promise this was going to be a different interview. Okay.
Yes.
So I'll give you not a specific example because some of the stories are being worked on, but I'll give you an example of something that was the high impact of the story. So there was this city who was working with Microsoft around the 911, being able to actually text 911 versus just call 911, right? Mm-hmm. So the system updates. So it can come in because obviously we text now. There's like, how are we modernizing these operations internally? During the beta testing period, which is still happening, I believe, or was happening at the time, a number came in, right? And so they knew that it was not from the actual beta testing environment. So it could have been someone who actually did text 911. So the first responders decided, we're going to go see what's up, like just to see. And it actually ended up being a real case of a woman who was being abused at the time. She couldn't get up the phone to call, but she actually texted and was saved. Yeah. So these are incredible, incredible stories touching people like you and I in real environments and how we're modernizing the services for citizens. So yeah, these are incredible stories.
It's amazing.
Because Miri, are you making the invisible visible? Is that what, like with the cloud and the technology, it's kind of behind the matrix for me because.
Yeah, you're right. So I would say that's a great anecdote to say, to explain this. It is kind of invisible to people, the sheer power of technology and how we're impacted every day. We're just enjoying it. And a lot of it and the user experience is more like the forefront of like, you know, apps and texting and social. But truly, what is it doing for us in the everyday that is changing inherently how, and I would say how a lot of underrepresented communities are now being represented. There's an equality factor that's coming up more and more through technology that enables people that didn't have those abilities before, because these are things that, you know, didn't exist back then or for them. And now they're becoming equalizers, right, for people. We have the gig economy that was born out of technology in general, where anybody can, you know, build a business, for example, which I love that. I love the idea that all you need is internet and an app. And, you know, so we have more opportunities today that may sound invisible. They're not. They're being created and they're here for you and I to really take advantage of it. I'm excited for it. I'm excited for all the things that, you know, technology does. So.
So cool.
Sometimes I want to know what your thoughts are about the different communities, because you just said underrepresented communities are being more vocal. Is that because of the social media and the kind of conversations big corporations are having with, you could say, their constituents in a way?
I would say, Ty, it's a great question. I would say it's beyond that. It's beyond the corporate world. I think what it is that people have seen that they have a voice and a platform. And I have lived that for my brand. So you and I would not be talking today had I not taken a chance 10 years ago to build my brand and voice my expert opinion, not just my opinion, my expert opinion, share my expertise, share my lived experience, talk about the how-tos and what I'm learning as I'm going through it, talk about the research that I'm doing. That put me on the map. And now I have a voice. And now people can, you know, within tech, I mean, when we add intersectionality to a woman in tech, so we represent 3% in 2023, 3% of the tech industry, you add intersectionality, that's actually less than 1% if it's a woman that is Latina. So that's me. I'm less than 1%. Yet I have a voice that I didn't have 10 years ago. And so where I look at these technologies are, you know, we can look at AI today and what it's doing. And people are like, how do I adopt this? Find out, go play, go try and find out how you adopt it, not for yourself and for immediate gain, but how is it going to drive a legacy, drive a story that's connected to you and your community and what you're doing and what you're doing it for. So I think it's beyond the corporate world and constituents and citizen empowerment. It is individual empowerment at that level. And I personally lived it. I mean, I can tell you that it's my story and that has taken me places I never even imagined. So
amazing. So yeah. In talking about brand storytelling for companies, our culture, I mean, our generation, and then definitely our kids' generation, they can smell BS from a mile away, right? I mean, they know. So what is the difference between storytelling and then just like BSing?
I love that. I love that question. I think it's a great question because there's a lot of that going on. And I think actually that's why I wrote the book. In fact, I never endeavored to write a book about this. I was in London and, you know, the publishing commissioner came up to me and they're like, you should make this a book. I'm like, no, I'm okay. And yeah. I said no like 3 times for like 3 months. I was just like not into it. But when she's really expressed, hey, Miri, you got to go and you got to tell people, like, this is one to many. When you write a book, many people will be able to learn. I was like, okay, good. Let's do this. And I say that because BS is a lot around storytelling. When it came out as a content strategy or a business forward strategy, people didn't know what it was. People were just saying, oh, I can just go tell a story and that's storytelling. No, I mean, there's a vast difference. Storytelling is a design thinking approach or a story design approach where you're looking at content and specifically in story form, and you're going to decide what that story is going to do for you for what. And it doesn't have to be sales or marketing. It can be, and it can be used as a tool in that. I sit in the sales organization at Microsoft in sales vertical, but it doesn't have to be. I've also sat in engineering. I've sat in marketing. I've sat in HR, and I've been able to apply it everywhere. What it is truly is the ability for you to tell. There's two stories in brand storytelling. The origin story, the story of the brand, the why. Mm-hmm. Why does it exist? Why is it still here? Why is it still relevant? If it was born 20 years ago, is the mission statement still relevant to today's audience? Does it still resonate? If not, change it. I mean, we did at Microsoft, right? So the why is it here? And that's something that you're never going to run out of telling people why you're here. That's your story and how it's evolving. The entity of the brand itself, the brand was born, it has friends and foes, it's evolving and growing. Hopefully it won't die yet, right? So there's this evolution that takes on, and there's core values. That's how we humanize the brand itself. What that does is enables people to move away mentally, psychologically from that's big tech, that's big Microsoft. They have all the money in the world. They're a $1 trillion company to, oh, there's Miri. She works at Microsoft and she's a human behind the brand. Oh, there's an engineer who is struggling. They all struggle. You're able to see past the big corporation idea into the entity and the core values that the culture of the brand. That's one. The second one is the ever-growing stories that confirm the why. So why are we creating a new product? Why are we moving from this stance to this stance? Why do we change our core values? And this is where you see a lot of different brands have missed it in their perhaps noble ideas of wanting to, for example, be woke. And they have changed their perspective, but they never told people why. They just woke up one day and decided, we're going to go this route and we're going to go out with this ad. And everybody was like, whoa, that just didn't resonate with me. We see that a lot. I mean, I can give you so many examples. And so I would imagine if, Gillette would have sat and explained what before the ad came out, why they decided to write to go this route.
Will you tell us that story, Miri?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's in the book. I give it as an example. So Gillette, if you may have heard of the toxic masculinity ad that went out a few years ago. And this is in the middle of the hashtag MeToo movement, a movement that for women, represented, hey, something's happened to me, abuse of some sort or microaggression or microaggressions. And so women were being more aware and were being more brave to speak about their own stories. And so in this movement period, there was this idea of what is masculinity and specifically toxic masculinity that came out. And so Gillette came out and actually did an ad about toxic masculinity, boys being boys equals toxic masculinity. So they had a lot of backlash from that and actually lost a lot of profit from that and the fallout of that eventually. And the reason was because historically their brand alludes to men. Men is their main audience.
The best a man can get, right?
Yeah. And so, and typically their ads historically have been sexist. I mean, they've been a sexist type ad to allure men because that is their main audience. And so now they're kind of, talking to men about being men and it being toxic. So men were like, wait, what? What just happened? Like, why they change your heart real quick? And so I think, again, opportunity, I can imagine them sitting at a table and say, hey, we really need to get on this movement and talk about where we stand here. And Noble at heart, they just didn't tell the brand story. They didn't say the why. I imagine if the CMO, for example, would have come out and said, right before the ad came out and said, hey, you know, as Gillette, we are standing behind this. We believe that there's opportunity for us to behave better as men, and then throw the ad, the impact, I think, would have been a lot better. So that's where storytelling comes in, where you can tell the story behind the why and be able to give context, especially in a very socially charged world where, you know, one thing is taken and out of context every 5 minutes. So you have an opportunity with the brand story to tell the story before you go out there.
Was your book written, Mitty, for other brand storytellers?
No. Not initially. What happened? So when I was presented with the book idea, my it was written for anybody who wanted to democratize and learn to design stories, not just tell them, because I saw a lot of confusion in the marketplace, in marketing and sales at every level, in every vertical, that people were just throwing around storytelling. And I was like, no, that's not it. That's not it. So it was an attempt for me, for anybody, actually, at the core, engineers, because engineers want to tell a story, but they don't know how. And they were my first audience in mind because I've worked with them and I see their hearts and they struggle so much. And I'm like, my gosh, when they actually get to tell a story, it is fascinating to hear what they have to say. So I wanted to democratize it for all. And it wasn't a specific audience in mind.
Whose responsibility is it to develop the story and maintain the story and make sure it's, you know, from the top all the way to the bottom? Who's responsible for that?
Yeah. So if you're talking about the corporate level and Microsoft specifically, is that what you're asking?
I think to say for any company, like who really should take ownership of making this happen and how, and then empowering, because it sounds like you guys have a story, but you actually were tasked with telling Microsoft's own employees what the story is, and also that maybe they helped develop it. Just tell us, like, logistically how that even works.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. So at Microsoft specifically, when this kind of storytelling movement started to happen as a content strategy, so there, most of the storytellers will sit in the CMO organization, the marketing organization. It belongs to the brand strategy, whether that's typically at a company, it'll sit within marketing, but really is brand strategy, wherever that sits in the organization. That goes along with whoever's creating the mission statement, whoever's rebranding, whoever's creating the company assets, you know, go-to-market strategies per se. That brand story aligns to all of that. It is part of that. When you think of your brand mapping, your story sits here visually, and then all the assets go around it. So the brand core values, the brand mission, the brand vision, the brand all sits around, and the story kind of sits in the middle because that's what really holds it together. That's why it exists. And so whoever is responsible would be, in our case, it would be our CMO. We have at Microsoft something called Brand Central. Of course, Microsoft is huge. I mean, we have 170,000 employees worldwide. So to keep that together and make sure everybody's telling the same story, a big endeavor to be able to create, you know, something that everybody can borrow from and make their own. So a lot of assets went into that. A lot of visual identity, storytelling identity, and education around, hey, this is the story. This is where you're going to draw from. And then you take it and make it your own, right? So if I'm telling a story of engineering by engineers to engineers, I can borrow from these specific core values and what this narrative is and create the next narrative around this main narrative. With the verticals, that's how it works. So every vertical will have their own storytellers, and that will take from the main narrative and be able to inform themselves and inform their stories, if you will, to go to market, internal or external. And so for me, in the case of engineering, I borrowed from those core values, and then I went on to tell specific stories of our engineers. And that was pretty much, you know, my jurisdiction. I got to play with that narrative and how to tell it. But there are some guidelines on how to go to market. So we all sound like Microsoft. We all sound synced, even though we're in different spaces at Microsoft.
Mitty, pretend somebody listening doesn't know what a vertical is. That person might be me, but can you...
Not a corporate jargon, I'm sorry. Yeah, verticals. Business units. So you have, you know, the business units that support sales. So typically you'll have operations, you have finance, you have customer service, HR, human resources. You have, you know, I don't know, marketing as another one. You have engineering, if that's, you know, or product, I would say product development. So these are all business units that are supporting the brand and the go-to-market in general. Within that, at the top, if you can imagine sales, which takes it all to market, usually, and sales will be usually close tied with marketing or brand to be able to bring these leads in as well. So all of these verticals or business units are supporting the operation, the sales operation.
So you're talking mainly about within a big corporation?
So within, let's say my small business, right? I have a small, you know, own business. It's a Be Mindful, Be Happy. And so within that, I have, and I'm doing a lot of stuff myself, obviously, because it's mine. But, you know,
Can you tell our listeners about Be Mindful, Be Happy, and me too, and Christine too?
Yeah. Yes.
Absolutely. So what Be Mindful, Be Happy, you know, I bought it in 2020 and 2021. And I wanted to bring it to the US. It was based in the UK. And so the entire, when I think about the story, if you read the story on my website, that's the story of the why. Why did I buy it? Why did I decide that? Why did I make that decision to come and buy something in the middle of COVID and then bring merchandise from India in the middle of COVID? Like all the things that I did, that's the story. And when I think about how, you know, I'm part of that brand, I'm that brand story because I did that. And I tell the story in different aspects of my business. When I talk about it, I'm representing the brand. My story really represents the brand. So in that same way, any corporation, small or big, and I would say even more for the smaller, because you're growing or you're establishing a specific market, emergent market, for example, your story is what sells. Your story is what people are going to tune into, not the product, not the product. And so they're going to know why I'm going to invest, why this is important. And once they hear that story, they go, I really want to support that. I really want to lean into that. That is the storytelling, is the emotional transfer of information, I say. And so it can really emotionally connect with people at that level versus the noise and the sales and all the other pitches that we can do.
So can you tell our listeners and tell us again what the story is behind Be Mindful, Be Happy? We definitely want to know now.
Sure.
I don't want to take the time on this to go
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, it was interesting. So in 2021, I was diagnosed with BRCA. It is a gene mutation that exposes you rapidly to several cancers, specifically reproductive system cancers. BRCA, BR stands for breast, CA for cancer. Typically, people with BRCA mutation will end up with breast cancer. Not all, but that typically will be the bigger one. There's also ovarian cancer, different ones. Long story short, in my history, I was the first one diagnosed in my family. And with that, in the history of my family, no breast cancer. I was having some issues with my ovaries. So my doctor, after doing some tests, determined it could be ovarian cancer. That cannot be, ovarian cancer cannot be detected, at all. So there's no way to detect it. When you have it, you'll just find out. And so they went in to do, it was an immediate idea of, hey, let's go and start proactively removing parts, right? So let's do your hysterectomy, eventually doing a double mastectomy. Wow. I was prepared for, the first thing was the hysterectomy, yet I was, I took a retreat with my family before the first surgery, because obviously it's going to be hard on me. And so we went away, and when I got back, I had like 30 messages from my breast doctor, which was, you know, I had taken all my mammograms, all clear, everything was fine. And she she couldn't sleep. And she had me on her mind and saying, I need you to come in. I need you to do something beyond the mammogram and the sonograms. And I was like, okay. So I come in and she ends up doing an MRI, and they did find in both breasts what they call cancer zero. So had she not been intuitive, they wouldn't have found that first. And so my order of surgeries changed, and I ended up going, like, it was like, okay, you're going to get this done, this done, this done. Long story short, I'm in the middle of five surgeries back to back from 2021 to 2022. Oh. And I woke up. Yeah. And so I woke up and I had a dream about Be Mindful, Be Happy. And the thing that got me through each, so the way that these surgeries were going to go is one had to be successful in order for me to get the next one, and for me to get the next one, and for me to get the next one, and hoping for reconstruction in the end. So that was not on the table until you were enough, like healthy enough. And so there was a lot of pressure of like not only recover, but recover within a period of time to be able to get the next surgery and so on and so forth. And I was like, how am I going to do this? Like, this is impossible. And mindfulness was what really saved me. I would say it was what got me through every single time. And my doctors were shocked at the recovery and how fast and how great I was able to recover and be prepared for the next surgery. And I was like, I got to do something with this. I got to tell people what mindfulness is, because I didn't know, I didn't understand it until I was in it. And I was, you know, it was an incredible personal experience that I was like, I need to tell people. And so be mindful, be happy. I told my husband, I was like, I want to invest in something that is physical out there so people can see. And then it's the channel for me to talk about it. So it's an e-commerce platform. It does have a lot of products, and they're all green, by the way. They're all ethical, and it's you know, back to back. I'm really proud of the products themselves. But what they are is they're a channel for me to tell the story about mindfulness and how it changed my life, and how it's really taken me from, you know, someone who was just on this rat race for everything. Corporate and goals and all the things, and just put me back and said, no, today, just worry about today. What's today look like? Are you here today? Are we here? You and I are here. This is it. No, this time can be taken away. We are here. How do we embrace that? Even with my friends, you know, on the phone and just doing something else, or no, just be, and you know, all you have is this moment, so enjoy it. Be mindful, be happy is my attempt to educate people to be mindful in life, in business, in everything they do, to just be present.
So Miri, how did you find your mindfulness practice during that insane time with all of, I have this image of you like doing the surgery Olympics, like the surgery decathlon. Did you already have a mindfulness practice, or what did that look like?
No. So I definitely had delved so deeply, deeply spiritual, born in a Christian home. My parents were pastors, and that was, you know, a foundation that I had. But I have to be honest, I don't know what I'm disrupting here, but I got to be honest, that didn't do much for me. Mm-hmm. Because there was a lot of false positives, a lot of positivity, not positives. It was a lot of like, God's got you. I'm like, really? That was it though? You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, what does that even mean? What does that mean? I'll be praying. Okay, what does that mean? Thanks for prayers. Mm-hmm. What does that even mean? Mm-hmm. So a lot of that became very cynical, rightfully so, about my process and going, what is true and what is not? And where does faith come in? And what is this? Where is it taking me? So I remember the hardest of all the surgeries, and I mean, each of them were really, really hard on their own. But the autopsy was the hardest because I had to be awake. I had to actually be awake for the procedure.
The autopsy?
So they do. Well, what they do is they find a spot through like the MRI, and now they have to go in before the surgery and clip the spot so that there's a spot where they find the cancer area so that they were doing first. So I had the autopsy, a lumpectomy,
hysterectomy. Oh, the biopsy. Hold on.
Yeah, the biopsy.
Okay. You're saying autopsy, okay. Like. You were dead.
Oh my gosh. No, sorry. The biopsy.
We were like,
I'm like, I think she means biopsy.
Okay. Biopsy. God, no, I didn't die. Thank God. Oh my God. Okay. Edit. Anyway, the biopsy. So when you go in, it's actually like, first of all, let's just call it out. It was in the middle of COVID, so no partners could be with you. It was really lonely, right? You just go in by yourself, right? So I go in, and it's a machine. It's like it's an MRI machine, but it's basically like almost like a massage machine where you lay down instead of up. And so what they go in, this part is open to the floor, and they're coming in from the bottom. All right. So what they're doing is what they're going to do is they're going to clip the area so that when the surgeon can goes directly to that area. Right. Mm-hmm. So they're basically clipping the area. And so I'm there and they go in with these tubes. They numb it. So I'm numb, but I'm feeling. I mean, I'm awake. And I had two nurses holding my hands. It was really a beautiful moment in terms of empathy. I'm laying down and then this first tube comes in and I'm looking. I mean, I could see the floor, but all of a sudden, all I see is just a burst of blood all over the floor. Just blood. And I can't move. I'm there and I can't move. I'm looking at this and it's just blood is gushing. And so they call more nurses and my surgeon's like, okay, we gotta call more nurses. And they're trying to stay calm. And I'm like, what is happening? And you talk about mindfulness. I had prepared myself, right? Mentally. I was like, I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm sitting there. I'm going, oh my God, like just what's happening? I'm dying on the table. Like I'm dying. And I, in the mindfulness approach, I was like, okay, wait, stop. You're here. You're still here. You're breathing, breathe. And so I was able to mindfully guide myself through the moment of keeping my anxiety down and waiting for the next step. Literally, it's like, okay, what is next? Just wait for the next step. Just wait for the next, over and over. What had happened? And so they were able to fix. They pierced through the tube had pierced through, which they didn't know there was a cyst in my breast. And so it erupted. And so and so they cleaned it, but can you imagine visually not knowing? My doctor in the end, after it was all said and done, she's like, I have had patients that I don't even start and they pass out, like just by laying on the table, they pass out. So what did I learn? There's this control that you take and then this peace that comes over when you're able to tap into what's bigger than this. And almost like I'm a spiritual being having a physical experience. I'm still here. Mm-hmm. I'm still here. This is not the end of me anyway. Like even if I'm leaving this on the table, if it ends up being a biopsy, it's okay. You know, an autopsy. I'm sorry. And so there's, you know, the anxiety is removed and that mindfulness of wait. And I had, by the way, the conversations with my son. I had sat them down and said, I may not make it. Each surgery, I may not wake up tomorrow. And I am okay with that. We are okay because this is where it's supposed to be and that's it. And so that is the mind. It's what we call the eternal present, not just being present. Eternal present is we know that in right now, in this point of eternity, there's no past and there's no future. This is it. We are here right now. And all of us is here. The body, spirit, and soul is right here. And so we can't be anywhere else. And so this is where we're going to be. And we're going to get through the next moment and the next moment and the next moment. And then, you know, here I am. So, yeah.
Miri, where did you cultivate that mindfulness practice? What you just said is so impactful. Did that come from a book or did you go to a guru? How did this happen to you?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It was a combination of things. It wasn't one book. I actually delved into many books, including the Bible. And I found a lot around mindfulness in the Bible, a lot around, you know, Solomon wrote a whole book about it, actually, in that context of the ever-present, the things that happen in the life and the cycles of life. And I believe, honestly, in my own personal experience, once you wake up to that idea, once you allow and begin to flirt with the idea of mindfulness, your heart opens to that. And I believe that every person's journey will be different based on their lived experience, but it all comes back to this life that we were given, this gift that, you know, the breath of God, right? That's what it is. And then, so we're here. And so for the whatever amount of time, and so being mindful of that, being aware and intentional that why are we worried about tomorrow? Or why, if, you know, it's this idea of if I'm sad, I'm living in the past. If I'm anxious, I'm living in the future. I'm being. And so, yes, there were books I read, but there were books that I had read before, but now made different sense to me. One of them was The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. And this is a book about a shaman and his tribe. And he's talking, you know, it's his learnings. And he's talking to his people about making agreements with yourself. Being conscious of who you're being with people. There was another one that everybody knows, The Alchemist. I've read it again and again and again. And I was like, oh my, it was like insights every single time. Yeah. I think it's beyond books because we have a lot of books out there to read. It's the perspective when you read with a different perspective or when you come into a knowledge with a different perspective, it's there. It's teaching you every 5 minutes. So,
my gosh. I love what you said about your heart opening. And so then it's able to receive things in a totally different way. So not only are you viewing things in a different way, you're receiving them in a different way. And I do need to ask, how is your health now, Mary?
Thank you for asking. I just went to the doctor for my 2 month post-op. So my last surgery was in July, and it was the final step of my reconstruction, where I was a candidate. And I'm so grateful for what they call nipple sparing double mastectomy, where they actually are able to keep your nipples, which to me, that was just, I didn't think I could do that. And I was just grateful to be able to go through the surgeries alone. But I mean, aesthetically pleasing, you know, post-surgery, of course, I'll take it. And one thing, I'll share this with you. Well, I guess with the audience, everybody's listening. I forgot. We're on a podcast.
Yeah, it's just us. It's just the three of us.
We're still here. Okay. Yeah. So I was post-surgery. I had one for surgery, and they did not remove the lymph nodes. They didn't think they need to, because they just removed the tissue on the breasts. And, you know, it was contained, so they didn't have to remove the lymph nodes. I was traveling about, I want to say, like, I don't know, 4 months ago. And I started to feel pain right over here. And I was like, oh, no, this is not good. Right. So I started to log the pain, and it was like onset weird. I had never felt that pain before. I logged it, called the doctor, and my doctor was like, he stood quiet for a second, which is never good. And I was like, doctor, I'm feeling this thing. He's asking, what kind of pain? You know, how long has it been? Whatever. And I'm giving him the answer. So he stays quiet. He goes, Miri, I don't know how to say this, but it sounds to me that your nerve cells are regenerating. And I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like, well, we don't really tell people because we don't want to promise anything. But obviously, when they remove all the tissue, you're severed. So you have no feeling left. So it's numb. It looks like your cells are you're starting to feel again. So you're going to basically, once that happens, your nerves are growing. You're going to get sensation back. Wow. And I'm like, you're kidding me. Like, this is crazy. So then he says to me, he's like, you know, I'm going to send you some prescription for, you know, to help you with the pain. And I was like, no, I don't want you to numb my pain. I want to feel my pain, because that means that I'm alive. It means that life is in me. Wow. And I say that because so long, and talk about mindfulness, we aim to not feel the pain. We want to just be comfortable. Right. And we just want to numb the pain all the time, numb it, physical, emotional. We want to numb the pain. And for the first time in my life, I associated pain with life and growth and positivity. And yes. And I was like, no, I need, every time I feel it, I'm like, I'm awake. It's happening. It's growing. Right. And so my nerves are growing. I think it's like 3 centimeters per month or something. And it's going to take like 2.5 years, but I'm back and I'm doing well. Back to answer your question. It's the miracle of life in all its sense of, you know, we expect nothing and then we get gifts because we put ourselves out there with no expectations, but we just want to live. And I think God definitely rewards that. So
wow, oh my gosh. I'm so glad to so glad to hear that. I know this is not the typical, I know you probably didn't talk about nipple sparing with the on the business podcast.
Your story is the best story.
That's the best story.
My story is the story. My story is Be Mindful, Be Happy. My story is the woman in tech. My story is the book. It's all of it. And that's exactly why it's important. Because as I shared this with you, Ty and Christine and, you know, and listeners, that's the why. That's the behind the scenes. And that's what connects you and I. Even if you've never gone through something like this, what connects us is the human experience. You've gone through something tough. You've also been in pain of some sort. And so you can relate to me and can relate to wanting to numb a pain in some way and then saying, maybe I shouldn't. Maybe I want to lean in and grow from this. And so we all have similarities in our lived experiences, I believe. And that's why stories are so powerful. They connect us.
So Mehdi, I want you to tell our listeners a little bit about how you handled all of those health issues with your work. Can you give us any, you know, golden advice from that experience that you went through?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I'll say, not just with work, with everyone, I recognized that I had been given certain truths that were not truths. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. I see a man culturally and as a woman, gender wise, I see a man in a white coat and he represents authority and I will not question his authority. Mm. That's the truth I've been given. And I went in with this whole, I'm like, whatever comes out of this, I may never come out of it. Doesn't matter. But here's what I leave on the table. I decided, wait, they're the experts in medicine. I'm the expert in my body. Yeah. And so I'm going to come in and I'm going to ask questions and I'm going to decide who will touch me, who will put their hands on me, will be my decision, and who aligns. You're my partner in this journey that I'm embarking on. I get to choose who I partner with. That was a very mindful approach. So I went in, and during COVID, I went in and started to actually interview doctors one by one. And I had a set of questions, 14 questions that I asked all of them. The last one being, okay, so they share their plan or they, you know, there's whatever they thought their thoughts was in terms of treatment. And there was, I would say, okay, if this was your mom, your wife, your sister, your daughter, would you tell them the same thing?
Wow.
That was my last question. Now, one thing that happened to me, and I bring that to your question, Ty, about work. What I did was, again, I was no longer, before that, I would have been so worried. I got to get back to work immediately. I had windows in between to recover. Maybe I'll come back 2 weeks. I'll come back 4 months. I was like, no, I'm going to take my time and I will recover, just like the doctor ordered. And if I don't come back to work, and if you need to hire somebody else, by all means, you got to go do your business. I got to do my business. My business is my body today. My business is my life. And so I took the approach of taking all of the time that I needed, which was a year and a half. And Microsoft was such a great company. They empowered me. They supported me 100% through the entire process. And when I came back to the role that I wanted. Just the love. I can't tell you how much love I felt from people and from HR and from the corporation. And so was I lucky? I don't think it's luck. I think it's a mindfulness intent to when you decide to honor yourself, other people honor you as well. So if I came in with fear that I may lose my job because I have to come back 6 months later or take an LOA or whatever, that fear transmits and people are like, oh, she, you know, she's okay. You got to come back. But I was like, no, I'm going to go do the thing. And I'll come when I come back, I come back. And if I don't, I don't. And that's okay. And I was back. And so that's about honoring. I treated my work. I treated people around me. I got to go honor myself. And I think that there was a lot of self-love that I needed to have there and push past those cultural norms, unlearn a lot of the learned things and show up as who I am and what I want out of this experience first. And I'm going to honor that. And you're going to partner with me, whether it was my work people or it was my medical team. So
I love that. And I dealt with pain for a very, 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 very long time and did the same thing where I trusted implicitly the doctors in the white coats because they had gone to Harvard Medical School and I had not gone to Harvard Medical School.
Right.
But the way I finally healed was same thing that you said, sort of, wait a minute, I'm no longer going to just trust them implicitly and not trust myself. I can trust myself too. I'm worth being trusted. And if they don't trust what I'm saying about my body, then that's kind of on them. And then also, and then also not telling, the doctors also tend to tell us stories about our own bodies.
Yes.
Your body is broken. Your body is this, your body is this. And I love just what I'm hearing is just, we can actually also tell stories about our own body, our own selves. And we should definitely not delegate that storytelling to someone else just because they went to Harvard Medical School.
No, you own your own narrative. I love that, Christine. I love that.
So important.
And for me, it saved me because a lot of, and for me, I told you I had some issues with my ovaries. For 4 years, I was basically bleeding. It wasn't breakthrough bleeding. It was like bleeding for 4 years and they couldn't find anything. And the doctors all were like, it's just stress. So I owned that narrative. Oh, it's stress. Stress. No, it wasn't stress. I was sick. They just couldn't find it. It doesn't mean that, you know, so I had to press further. And so that's the kind of thing and you talk about going inside. We do have that internal voice and we have to quiet. This is mindfulness. Again, when you're mindfully quieting all the noise around you, everybody has an opinion. Everybody has something to say. Quiet the voices. You're able to go inside and really understand what's your voice, what it's telling you and where it's telling you to go. It's guiding you. Call that the Holy Spirit, whatever you want to call it. It's inside you. It's guiding you.
Yeah. Another, to bring it back a little bit, just to the, to the book.
Yes.
And since you were talking about quieting and being silent, there was a really interesting example I'd love for you to share with our listeners was about when it's time to, you know, tell a story, or when it's good for a company to tell a story, but also when is it good for a company to be silent? And if you could tell us the Corona story, I think our listeners would really enjoy that.
Absolutely. So, you know, as I am in this field of brand storytelling, I do observe, I research brands in the market and, you know, to be able to see what they're doing and how they're doing it. And so I was absolutely curious and observant of a Corona beer brand during 2020. We were calling it first coronavirus. So Corona, for those of us in the Western Hemisphere, are very familiar with the brand. It's a Mexican brand, and Corona being a beer brand that it's drank is very popular here in the States. So my mind went there. I was like, oh, I wonder what Corona is doing, right? Because everybody's talking about coronavirus. And I found it fascinating that the minute the lockdown happened in the US, they decided to just, you know, pause all of their social, and they didn't say anything at all for the next 8 months. They said nothing. And I was waiting, you know, I was just like, what are they going to say? And they said nothing. Ironically, or maybe not, people were staying home. There was a lockdown and people were drinking, obviously, because we were bored. And the sales for Corona actually went more than they were higher year over year than the year before. And then in 2021, even higher. So this is public information. You can find it out on your own. And I found that extremely fascinating. What I thought happened here in terms of making the decision to not tell a story, when we are silencing, when we're saying not nothing, we're also saying something, right? It's a form of communication. Our silence is also valuable in this economy where content is, you know, king, and we have to go say something. Sometimes not saying something, it's also a message. It sends a message for those who are listening. And I really believe, and I haven't talked to them, but I have been saying this since 2020, that when I observe this, I do believe that whoever made that decision very empathetically said, hey, you know, we're going to be on the minds and hearts of people, whether we want it or not. People are saying Corona. Let's just say nothing. And let's just pause. And I think because truly they were in our minds, and the fact that they were empathetic to the deaths and the tragedies that were occurring worldwide, people actually supported the brand, which I think is fascinating. So when to tell the story, when not. And a great question. It's always around your audience, where they are in their journey. A lot of times we think we know what the audience wants. If we are mindful and we stop and we say, where are they today? What are they feeling? What is that environment that is going on? And how do we react to that? We intuitively will be able to do more than just the marketing plan or the sales plan that we had, you know, that we created months ago. And it's that opportunity we have to say, maybe not today, maybe it's not, you know, maybe we should pause, maybe we need to say nothing, and that sends the right message. So that is mindfulness to me, that it's being able to pause and understand the environment, what is driving the audience, the feel of the audience, whatever the audience may be for you. So.
Thanks, so Mehdi. That's so interesting. Yeah. I want, before we let you go, I wanted to kind of circle back to something you said in the beginning, which is that you're like part of less than 1% as a Latina woman. What would you say, what will you say to all the less than 1% out there? If you're 18 years old, if you're 20 years old, what story do you want to tell all the people who feel othered or not, maybe just mainstream?
Yeah, I will say, tell your story, because if you don't, somebody else will. And it's not going to be you. It's not going to be your story. It'll be somebody else's narrative of you. And so you have the power to own your story, craft it, share it, be able to design it in a way that has a mission. Why am I telling the story? What is this for? What do I want people to know about me? You have that power. You have that power. And so for any woman, 18 and 99, we for so long, historically, our voices have not been heard. Our voices have been silenced even. And so we have, when we live in this beautiful era of technology and connection and information, the information era, where now we can share information. So let's not shy away from this opportunity. Let's leave a legacy for our next generations. If I didn't stand up to share my stories and my voice and write a book, there's another, you know, Venezuelan little girl who maybe wants to write a book and she's like, I can't. No, you can. I did. You know, I didn't go to the moon, but I wrote a book, so you can. So it's this idea of our stories are beyond ourselves. They actually create this space for inviting other women to also share their stories of triumphs and of hurt and of learnings. We can learn from each other. We can encourage each other. And then we can create a space where other women can do the same beyond ourselves. So please, if you take nothing else out of this crazy podcast that went everywhere, you know, I'll leave it like this. When it's time for your autopsy, write it, write your story, write how you want to die, write what you want to do, and write why. It's really important.
I love that.
Love it.
And I'm reminded of our past episode. We had Christine Hunchofsky, state representative for Florida. And she had said, you've got to tell us your stories because you, like you had said, Mary, someone else will. And it's going to affect you because if your stories aren't heard, the laws will not be made for you. So it has so much reach and so much importance, not only telling your story, but who are you telling it to? And tell it to the people that can actually make good change. And you, of course, all of our listeners can make good change.
All of us. That's what we're here to do. Mm-hmm. Our stories are what that change the world. Well, we got to tell them.
Yeah. So. Mary, thank you so much for spending time with us in the eternal present. this was a wonderful interview. And for our listeners, again, this is the second edition. I think I failed to mention that in the beginning. Second edition of Brand Storytelling. Great book. Put customers at the heart of your brand story. And it actually has practical kind of workbooks that you can work through as a business owner. But even for individuals to try to, you know, just kind of nail down what's important to you and telling your own story in the world. So thank you so much. I hope you'll join us again.
Oh God, thank you for having me. And now I'll have to join you in person because I know we've connected on so many levels. Now I live here. We got to do it.
Exactly.
when I'm traveling.
All right. Well, thank you, listeners. We will see you next time on Uncharted Living. Bye.
Thank you, Mary. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you so much for spending another week with us. Follow us at Uncharted Living Podcast on Instagram and TikTok. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. And please like and share this episode with your favorite fellow human.